You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Pleased to be joined now by Joe Concha, the media reporter and columnist for The Hill. You see Joe regularly on Fox, and you can read his columns on The Hill, of which all of them are excellent. Joe, thanks for joining Mornings on the Mall.
Mary, Vince, good to hear from you. What are we talking about?
Oh, literally everything. So I'm going to try and move through this rapid fire.
So settle in.
This is a week of media insanity. Let's start with ESPN. They decide to remove this guy, Robert Lee, from calling the UVA game. You've written about this. I mean, everyone seems to know about this story. What's your take on it?
Well, my take is that Robert Lee is an Asian American. He can never be confused with a dead Confederate general. And ESPN created a firestorm that never would have existed if they moved him off the game. Think about it, guys. You never heard of Robert Lee, I would imagine, before the announcer, before this whole controversy came. 99% of Americans probably never had either. And if the concern was, well, you know, some memes may come up, some mean memes may come up if they hear a Robert Lee is calling a game in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia, and we want to avoid Robert, you know, being maybe heckled or harassed. Well, you could have moved him off the game quietly because no one knew he was working in the first place outside of maybe his broadcast partner. So that's the whole problem there with ESPN. They created a controversy where it did not exist, and obviously now I heard a saying that it's called MS-ESPN.
Yes.
At this point, you can make that argument that they've gone so liberal in their political views, and all people want is to go there, get scores, watch sports, and not have to have that rammed down their throat in that venue.
It's 2017's most perfect story. ESPN, looking to avoid memes, decides to use a not racist element of their program and get rid of it on racist terms. It's really perfect. It's insane.
You said it better than I did.
I want to move on to CNN. I've spent a lot of time this morning focusing on CNN for any number of reasons. One of them is that Brian Stelter, on his media reporting program, has begun what appears to be a concerted effort across that network to constantly refer to issues about Trump's mental health. They're just raising questions, he says. He said it a lot, and not just him. Literally, almost every news anchor that is on that network has raised questions about Trump's mental health this week. Many of them pegged to James Clapper suggesting something about it, too. What do you make of CNN just sort of riding this horse like it's a campaign?
It is amazing, and you noticed the same thing I did, that coincidentally, on Sunday, Brian, who's a media critic and reporter like I am, starts a narrative, and now everybody else, the network, is following that narrative. It's as if they're singing from the same sheet of music or a memo or something. But, hey, I'm just speculating. Everybody that is speaking about President Trump's mental health on that network, from its media critic to its hosts to other pundits they have on there, none of them are psychiatrists or doctors at last check. So if you're going to go down this road, maybe you book an expert to talk about the president's mental health issues or lack thereof.
But Joe, the
you're
thing,
right. This just seems like a narrative that is being pushed out of virtually nowhere just because those folks disagree with Trump's message. Not
yes.
So much because he has a mental problem.
And the basis for this, remember, let's place this in context. Brian Stelter is the media critic for the network. His job is actually to assess the validity and the process of reporting. And when he looks at this, his view of this and the way he brought it up on Sunday was to say, reporters talk about this when the cameras are off, so therefore I thought I'd share it with our audience. What you're saying is idle gossip inside of CNN is occurring, and therefore I'm going to tell you what it is. That's not reporting. That's literally advancing gossip and turning it into a national news story.
Yeah, I believe Brian Stelter said in newsrooms people are talking about Trump's mental health. Well, Brian, outside of the New York CNN headquarters newsroom, where else have you been? Well, obviously nowhere else but CNN. So that is an excellent point, Vince, that he is literally talking about reporters, anchors, hosts, pundits at CNN that are talking about this, not across newsrooms, which is the way that he portrayed it. So, look, I'm disappointed in Brian. I used to think that he... I always knew that he leaned left, but now he has gone into being a full advocacy journalist and is saying some and reckless things at this point, and no one seems to keep him in check because I guess they like the narrative that is being pushed from an executive level.
You know, Joe, I'd like to move over to the Wall Street Journal. The editor-in-chief there, Gerard Baker, who's the editor-in-chief, sent out some late-night emails, and he criticized the reporters over their coverage of Trump's rally in Phoenix, and he said, sorry, this is commentary dressed up as news reporting, and he added, could we please stick to reporting what he said rather than packaging it in exegesis and selective criticism. Those emails were leaked to the New York Times. So clearly some of his reporters thought this was so egregious and so outrageous that they leaked it to the New York Times. What does this say about the state of any kind of journalism? Is it just rogue and it's just the Wild West within the ranks?
Well, first of all, I saw this story kind of blowing up yesterday and saying, oh my God, Gerard Baker took his reporters to task because they're editorializing too much in their straight news reports. And I'm saying, okay, well, I get what you're saying. Like, yeah, the leaked emails are troubling that a Wall Street Journal owned by Rupert Murdoch, the executive chairman of 21st Century Fox, and obviously Fox News, would leak these to their biggest competitor, the New York Times. Well, what's the story here? If Baker is the editor-in-chief and he sees reporters going off in an editorial, I'm sorry, in an opinion direction, all he's saying is, let's take that out because that shouldn't be in a straight news report. It sounds to me like he's actually doing his job as an editor. Instead, he's being criticized for criticizing his reporters. Well, I work for The Hill, and my editors change what I write sometimes, or they say, hey, Joe, that's a little bit over the line, or maybe you should alter this or modify this or remember this point. That's the whole point of an editor-in-chief. So, yeah, the leaked emails are troubling, but I don't see one thing that Jared Baker did wrong.
Well, the leaked emails are suggestive of a rebellion by the reporters. It's not, I mean, it's not just about the competition with the New York Times. It's clearly that you have reporters who are insubordinate here, and for reasons that are not just. They're because they believe that editing is oppressive. Those emails, if you were going to leak emails that were damaging to Gerard Baker, what you would leak is like, hey, I want to go easy on Trump. Those are not the words he used. He said explicitly that he wanted to be loyal to the facts. And who's going to disagree with that in the pursuit of journalism?
Yep, the exact quote is, could we please just stick to reporting what he said, Trump, then packaging it in selective criticism. Okay, makes sense to me. This is commentary dressed up as news reporting. That's where he says somewhere else. But let's be careful here. This could just be one reporter who's angry about the way he's being told to do his or her job.
True.
It might not be a reporter's rebellion within the Wall Street Journal. It could just be one bad apple.
That's true, but we saw some ex-Wall Street Journal reporters immediately in the wake of this tweeting about like how they feel for their comrades over there and how everybody seems to be oppressed. This is just a bizarre story, and one that I think right now, as far as the facts go, are in Gerard Baker's favor.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And, you know, there's a media critic, I don't know if you ever heard of him, Jeff Berfisozzi. I'm not pronouncing that correctly, and I apologize. He once said that the divide between news and editorial is one of the fundamentals of journalism. People are able to move back and forth across that divide, taking care not to allow their personal views to color their news reportage. And that has been completely eviscerated. And we see that in cable news all the time, where straight news anchors like an Anderson Cooper or even a Shepard Smith on Fox tend to be editorializing a little bit more. And if that's the case, then fine, don't call yourself an anchor anymore. You're now a host. And you could opinionize all you want, and that's that. But it seems like even the straightest of news reporters, even on the evening news, are suddenly saying, you know what, let me make it more about me and share my personal feelings because I want to do what's right in my mind, and that's a big problem.
Joe, I think you've summarized media in the Trump era. I really appreciate you stopping by to give us a quick rundown. There's much more to come, so we'll definitely have you back.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Good morning. Joining us right now is Mark Krikorian. He is the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Mark, good morning and welcome to Mornings on the Mall.
Glad to be here.
Wanted to talk to you about rumors that we're hearing from many different parts of the media, suggesting that President Trump's aides are pushing him to strike a deal using the Dreamers in exchange for getting some of the other things that he wants in immigration. So he gives the Dreamers amnesty, and then he gets funding for the wall, he gets more detention facilities, and he gets to implement E-Verify. Do you know anything about this? Does any of this have any validity?
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't know because I only know what I read in the newspapers. Except that this is something I've been pushing now for months. That if they can get a deal, a substantial deal, of trading a legitimate amnesty for the Dreamers instead of the illegal one that they have now that Obama gave them, if they can actually get not just E-Verify and some money for the wall, but also legal immigration reductions that of the kind that are in the bill called the RAISE Act that Senator Cotton introduced, then that would be a deal worth looking at. The concern is, will they actually try to drive a hard bargain and get that? What I've feared is that they're going to end up trading an amnesty for the DACAs just for a little bit of money for the wall. And that would be a terrible deal if that's, in other words, there's a potential for a deal here. I just don't know that the folks in, that too many of the folks in the White House and certainly in the congressional leadership are actually committed to driving as hard a bargain as possible. I think they might give a DACA away for nothing.
Well, I'm glad you're here this morning. This is, by the way, I just want to break the fourth wall for a second. This is another reason why you should listen to to Mornings on the Mall regularly, because Mark, as you just said, you told us about this a long time ago, that this is the kind of thing that you were floating out there, that maybe trading giving on DACA, allowing this amnesty for dreamers, would be a good way to get a lot of leverage on conservative desires for immigration. And so, Mark, My view of this, for people like you who follow immigration closely, the reason why you're typically reticent to offer amnesty in any capacity is because every time it's been tried throughout history, including in the 80s during Reagan's time, is because the promise is we do immigration, we do border security, amnesty rather, it'll be fine. Everything will be fine and we won't have to do this again. Yet we have to keep coming back to the table and granting yet another amnesty, yet another amnesty, yet another amnesty.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that's always the danger. That's why this is a little bit of amnesty, as it were, because it would be, you know, there's about 800,000 people who have this DACA amnesty already. So that's the first point. Second is, they've already been amnestied by Obama. This is kind of upgrading their amnesty from, you know, amnesty light to amnesty platinum or something like that. But the third point is, that's part of the point of the trade-off, is to get things up front instead of the kind of deal that President Reagan signed, and, you know, it was plausible at the time, 30 years ago, where the amnesty came first and the promises to have enforcement came later and were just ignored.
Well, this is the beef with the Gang of Eight bill, too, which is the belief that it had no capacity to actually get the enforcement down first before the immigration, before the amnesty as a precondition. And that infuriated people like you because you were saying, we're just going to be hoodwinked yet again.
Exactly. And that's why, like the Gang of Eight bill, everybody would have been amnestied. A deal like this is a little bit, in other words, it's you give Chuck Schumer and the Democrats a little bit of what they want, not all of it, in exchange for some portion of what we would want. And those things aren't promises. For instance, if you get rid of the visa lottery and some of these chain migration categories, you just get rid of them. I mean, if they're eliminated from the law, they're gone. There's no promise involved. It's just eliminated. You see what I mean? So that it's kind of like Middle East peace. You get a little bit, you give a little bit, you do confidence buildings to see whether you can then move to the next step, rather than the Gang of Eight bill, which was to try to package everything into this monster package and hope that it would work out.
Given that Nancy Pelosi has said that it's reprehensible to treat children as bargaining chips, do you see the Democrats coming to the table?
Well, I mean, first of all, Nancy Pelosi doesn't matter in this debate, because if the Republicans were committed to this, it would pass the House. It's only the Senate that matters. And secondly, Nancy Pelosi doesn't seem to know what she's talking about, because the people who have this DACA amnesty, this two-year renewable work permit amnesty, by definition, they're adults. They're all adults. You can't get it if you're a child. And in fact, the oldest ones are now turning 36 years old this year. I mean, do the Democrats so infantilize people that 36-year-olds are still called children?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think this does to his base, though? How does Trump's base receive something like this? I don't think it's going to sit well with them.
No, I don't think it will. And that's partly his fault. I mean, if you get rid of Steve Bannon, for instance, and you don't keep the promise that he made to phase out DACA, you're having trouble with credibility with your own base. Whereas, if the president had stopped on day one issuing new DACA work permits, because they're still giving new ones out to people who don't have them, and said, "We don't like this, but we're going to keep doing renewals until the end of the year," to work with Congress. Here's the kind of thing we propose to do this. It would phase it out. It would start the clock ticking and light a fire under the Democrats to do something, but show that he was at least trying to keep his promise on this. Instead, on January 20th, they didn't end DACA. They didn't start phasing it out. And my rough calculation based on the little data we have is that they've been giving out almost 200 new work permits to new illegal aliens under this program every single day, not just renewing them, but expanding it. And so, you know, this problem of angering their base is partly of their own creation. You can have flexibility if people trust that you and your staff are doing the right thing. And the problem is, I think a lot of that trust isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, this will be a real test, I think, for the president to demonstrate that he is a deal maker. And this is a bargaining chip, I think, that they should use and use effectively if they hope to get anything done on immigration. It's unlikely that the RAISE Act will specifically be the thing that gets through. But it's possible here. Maybe they'll get something done, Mark. I really appreciate your insight on this, though.
Thank you.
That's Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. It is now.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us right now on WMAL is Robert Spencer. Robert is the director of Jihad Watch. He's also the author of a new book, very timely, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. Love the title. Robert Spencer, good morning. Welcome to Mornings on the Mall.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
So I want to know why your group is so hateful and so hateful that you had to be banned from PayPal.
Well, you know what happened? The Southern Poverty Law Center for years now has been labeling ordinary and completely legitimate, reasonable groups like mine, not advocating violence, not calling for vigilante action, not demonizing anybody, but just simply telling truths that the left doesn't really want out there. And they've been lumping us in with groups like the neo-Nazis and the KKK on their hate group list. So after Charlottesville, the left is taking these hate group lists from the Southern Poverty Law Center and is trying to deny any access to any platforms and shut out all these people. And people think, oh, that's great. We'll get rid of all these Nazis. The problem is that the hate group list is so flawed and it contains legitimate conservative voices. So PayPal shut us down on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, not just your site, but a lot of organizations have been listed as hate groups or considered hate sites for any number of reasons, including opposition to gay marriage. Simply, you have Christian organizations like the FRC, which stands, you know, is opposed to gay marriage on they say religious grounds. They've been identified as a hate group, and you remember, I think it was 2013, you had a shooter go into their building with the saying that and attributed his decision to go there to the Southern Poverty Law Center's target list of hate groups. And this SPLC is treated as almost as if it's a government agency, like by the press. You see routinely journalistic organizations citing them not skeptically at all. This is a hate group, and you got lumped in with this, and as a result, PayPal went after your site.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's incredible how the establishment media acts as if this is a completely legitimate group when they're the ones whose teachings have actually incited violence. And in reality, the Southern Poverty Law Center has never listed any groups like Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter or any of these groups that are out there beating people up on the streets. They're never listed as hate groups. It's only groups on the right that are lumped in and tarred, smeared by association with these neo-Nazis. And the press never asks, well, wait a minute, who watches the watchman here? How do we know this is really a neutral and impartial arbiter of what's a hate group and what isn't?
Well, in addition to like pointing out SPLC's obvious deficiencies, there's a lesson here for a lot of people who may wonder, how is it that you were able to get PayPal to reverse their decision? What was the thing that you guys did in order to make them, you know, see the light, see the truth here?
Well, Jihad Watch still has a considerable audience, and so I called for a boycott of PayPal, asked people to contact them and tell them that this was outrageous. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a jihadi who was found to have financed his terror attack by raising $8,000 via PayPal. And so the idea that jihadis can use this platform, but foes of jihad terror can't, it was outrageous. PayPal was inundated with protests, and they backed down. And as the left continues to try to shut down the freedom of speech for those it opposes, that is a very good victory, very important victory, and a good object lesson.
Yeah, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, headed by Pamela Geller, was also targeted. They also were successful in getting this reversed. I believe, though, that they say that they are not going to continue to use PayPal, and I believe you, too, are no longer going to use PayPal as well, if you can avoid it. Are there other groups, though, that have been targeted by PayPal that have not been as successful as you in reversing the decision?
Yes, that's right. There have been. I don't know actually the status of Faith Freedom right now. That's a group run by an ex-Muslim, Ali Sina, who just calls it as he sees it. And I heard this morning that Politically Incorrect, a counter-jihad group in Germany, has been shut down by PayPal. There's a concerted effort to not only PayPal, but block groups that are outside the left's agenda, from Google, from Facebook, from Twitter, and it's ongoing.
In what world are the people who oppose jihad the hate group?
This is something, yeah, it's. I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is something that I've been dealing with for like 20 years. I was appalled when I wrote my first book, which is way back in prehistory, and I thought that there was going to be reasonable discussion of these issues, and instead I was labeled a hate monger. And I realized quickly this is a tactic that groups tied to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, like the Council on American Islamic Relations, use in the United States to shut down any discussion of the motivating ideology of jihad terror. They don't want to discuss. They don't want to debate. Well, they would lose if they did. And they do it consistently, and they never break character, is claim that opposing jihad terror, that speaking about how jihadis use the Quran, the teachings of Islam, to justify violence, and make recruits among Muslims who are peaceful, that even to talk about that is hateful and bigoted and Islamophobic. Clearly, they just want to make sure that nobody really knows what motivates these jihadis, and that's why we have this ongoing discussion about whether we should even call it Islamic terrorism.
Well, Robert Spencer, congratulations on at least a small victory here, turning back a tech company attempting to label you as a hate group. I do think, you know, the reality is, luckily, you've got a big platform. There are a lot of people who don't. They have much smaller platforms. And by the way, Robert Spencer's book is called The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies, a timely book released by a man who's under fire for that very thing, free speech. Robert Spencer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us right now to tell us everything you need to know about what's going on inside Washington, D.C. is Ed Henry from the Fox News Channel. Ed, good morning and welcome
good
to
morning.
Mornings on the Mall. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. We're glad to have you. Wanted to talk to you about whether there is a feud or there is not a feud between President Trump and Mitch McConnell. We know that Mitch McConnell came out and when President Trump complained about the lack of progress on the health care bill and said that the president had high expectations, unrealistic expectations, and that seemed to set the president off. But then we heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders say that the relationships between the two are just fine. So everything's great. But now President Trump was at it again with the debt ceiling, tweeting yesterday they didn't do it now. So we have a big deal with the Democrats holding them up as usual on debt ceiling approval. Could have been easy. And now it's a mess. So what is the deal?
Yeah, he wanted Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan to attach lifting the debt ceiling to a relatively non-controversial veterans reform bill that he's just signed into law and thinks, hey, if you just attach that, it would have been easy peasy and everybody would have moved on. Now, there are a lot of people on the Hill who say it's not quite that easy because there would have been some Republicans making noise about how, as you know, when they raised the debt ceiling, which is more and more money being borrowed by Washington, conservatives in particular want to see some spending cuts and say, hey, let's attach that. So it may not have been as easy as the president said. Here's the bottom line. I think this is a president who ran against the swamp. He's now seeing polling showing that people think, well, he's now maybe becoming part of the swamp. He's in Washington. He can't escape that. And despite all the promises made by Republicans for 7 years, the president also made promises about repealing and replacing Obamacare, at least for the last year and a half or so, as a candidate for president. Not 7 years, but he's on board with that as well. And I think he's getting more and more frustrated at the gridlock and the lack of progress here in Washington. People have been frustrated about that, I suspect, not just for years, but for decades. And now he's facing it. He's trying to separate himself a bit from these Republican leaders. But as you know, he needs these Republican leaders to get his agenda back on track. And we've got some new information this morning reporting at Fox that the president next week is going to go back on the road. He's going to Missouri on Wednesday. He'll be talking taxes. And I think that's important because, you know, rather than all this back and forth with Mitch McConnell and the tweet, if he can get focused on actually doing these rallies like he did in Phoenix, but not be about, you know, attacks, especially on his fellow Republicans, but go out and start selling tax cuts, selling broader tax reform. Reform. That's what not only his base wants to hear, but I suspect there are a lot of people in the middle of the country, independents and others, who also want to hear about tax reform and about actually getting some stuff done in Washington. So that's going to happen next Wednesday in Missouri ahead of Congress coming back to session. And I suspect in the fall he's really hoping to get this agenda back on track.
You said you want to get to the bottom line. The bottom line that I'd love to get to, and maybe you can illuminate it, Ed, is whether or not there's actually going to be anything left in 2017, like in terms of getting anything done legislatively. They pushed on Obamacare. They couldn't even get the simple majority there. The president pushing for a filibuster reform this morning in tweets. There seems no chance that they'll, again, get to the 51 votes they would need for that or whatever. I mean, they can't.
Right.
So is there any chance of getting legislation done this year, despite whatever noise these two sides have made?
Yeah, I hate to be a pessimist, and I'm usually an optimist, but I feel like there's a very narrow window to get very much of anything done. And I think what we're headed for is what we saw in the Obama years, which is, you know, governing by a CR or a continuing resolution, you know, the jargon for basically a catch-all spending budget bill that'll be slapped together in October, November, you know, we'll be careening towards possible government shutdown and all the rest.
Yes.
And at that point, the president will get some victories, quote unquote. But the question is going to be, you know, do they slap some sort of a tax cut in there at the last minute that gets Republicans on board? But then they have to throw some sweetness for Democrats and all kinds of new spending that Republicans won't be happy about. So my bottom line is the president going to get some legislative victories by the end of the year? Yes. But where he's headed right now, I just simply don't see some major infrastructure victory, some major tax, you know, structural tax reform, which is what conservatives really want. I see some middle class tax cuts that everybody can support, some marginal things, and that border wall is going to be a big fight.
Yeah, it will be. And there's, and also the future of DACA and whether or not that's used as leverage in order to get the border wall, for instance.
Yeah.
You said the president's going to hit the road next week to try and pitch some things, but he's hitting it at a strange time because right now he's dealing with this major natural disaster that's coming into Texas and may actually lead to some major flooding. We talked to your colleague Janice Dean earlier that flooding is going to dominate the news and up to and including Wednesday of next week. That's going to throw the entire week into chaos and require his attention.
It will. And look, you know, you see people already talking about it on social media that this will be a test for the president. We all know about Hurricane Katrina and what that meant for Democratic officials on the local level and for then President Bush on the federal level. President Obama had the oil spill that he had to deal with. I think especially coming out of Charlottesville and people still saying, did he say enough? Did he do enough? He obviously wants to turn the page on that. This is a more direct natural disaster where, you know, the criticism about Charlottesville to me was about whether he was showing leadership as president, whether he's using the bully pulpit. When you have a natural disaster like this, this is an opportunity for the president to step up, show that he gets it, go over to FEMA, make sure everybody's on top of it. You know, as Janice Dean and others are saying, that this is, you know, weather strong enough that we could really see, as you say, flooding, but also potentially lost lives and lots of injuries, you know, millions or billions of dollars in lost business. These kinds of situations really cry out for presidential leadership. And so you're right, the president's going to have to keep his eye very close on that all weekend.
Well, Ed Henry, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it every time you do.
Have a great weekend.
You give us all the news that we need to know coming out of Capitol Hill. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Take care.
That's Ed Henry, Fox News Chief National Correspondent and New York Times best-selling author of 42 Faith.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9 Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Oh, you hear that? That's the theme music to Wonder Woman, this new movie that's just absolutely crushed it in the box office this year. I haven't seen it yet. I still want to, featuring Gal Gadot. James Cameron is in the news now, though. He's the director of Terminator, and he was asked to talk about this Wonder Woman thing and this phenomenon, and he knocked it. He made it seem like whoever made this movie wasn't a feminist enough for him. What? So he's in an interview with The Guardian. He wrote, "All of the self-congratulatory backpatting Hollywood's been doing over Wonder Woman has been so misguided. She's an objectified icon, and it's just male Hollywood doing the same old thing. I'm not saying I didn't like the movie, but to me it's a step backwards. Sarah Connor, from Terminator, was not a beauty icon. She was strong. She was troubled. She was a terrible mother, and she earned the respect of the audience through pure grit." So James Cameron, I guess, saying that, you know, the Wonder Woman character, just not feminist enough for him.
The Wonder Woman outfit, no woman in her right mind is going to wear a corset out in public unless you're like 20. That's number one. Number two, you're certainly not going to wear a corset that's made of like steel or whatever that thing is, because that's just going to cut in. That's just not comfortable.
She's a part of an alien race.
And things like that.
We like risk takers.
Wardrobe malfunctions. Uh-huh. So let's face it, the corset, the outfit is for the men with the high boots. It's for the men, that part of it. So in that aspect, I get what he's saying.
But she's
saying.
Kin
her
and
hair
tail.
Is down. It's not even in a ponytail. What woman doesn't wear her hair in a ponytail? She's going to fight crime.
Okay, so she has an unrealistic capability to maintain
have
fashion
sense
and
hair.
To fight people physically.
Yeah, and not have wardrobe malfunctions and wear her hair beautifully. See, so that part of it I get. The rest of it, though.
But meanwhile, the female director of the movie Wonder Woman has clapped back, as the kids say. She said, "Strong women are great. His praise of my film Monster and our portrayal of a strong yet damaged woman was so appreciated. But if women have to always be hard, tough, and troubled to be strong, and we aren't free to be multidimensional or celebrate an icon of women everywhere because she's attractive, then we haven't come very far, have we?"
I agree with her on that.
Good for her.
This is the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Oh, yes. Italy. You know,
your people.
You know, if you were looking for the Italian version of Donald Trump, look no further than the mayor of Venice, a guy by the name of Luigi Brugnaro. This guy, you should hear the way he's talking about terrorists. The mayor of Venice, Luigi Brugnaro, has declared that if anyone wants to shout Allahu Akbar in his city, he will send them straight to Allah and shoot them immediately. This is his anti-terror policies. This is his anti-terror policy in the beautiful city of Venice. Venetians will not suffer terrorists, he's basically saying. Other Italian leaders are a little bit upset about his bluntness on the subject. But he points out, he goes, "In contrast with Barcelona, where they had not set up protection, we keep our guard up. If anyone runs into St. Mark's Square shouting Allahu Akbar, we will take him down. A year ago, I said after four steps. Now I say after three." And then he goes on, "I will say it in Venetian, je speremo," which means we will shoot him.
Let me ask you a question, though. First of all, they're not allowed to have guns in Italy. Are they allowed to walk around with guns?
I don't know Venetian gun laws, but this guy's not suffering fools.
This guy. Here's the thing. I'm thinking, isn't it hard to be a terrorist in Venice because you have to paddle everywhere? You can't make a quick getaway, right? Are you going to paddle your canoe?
Like Shep Smith to call those car chases.
What are those boats called?
The gondolas?
Gondola.
Yes.
You got to paddle your gondola quickly into a crowd of other gondolas?
Yeah.
What is the terrorist threat in Venice?
Well, it's not great because this guy is making sure to take it on. "In Venice, we arrested four terrorists," he said, "who wanted to blow up the Rialto Bridge, saying they wanted to go to Allah. But we'll send them straight to Allah before they can do any damage."
Oh, that's right. They have the bridges. I forgot about the bridges.
He adds in a Trumpian way, "I've never been politically correct. I am incorrect. I would shoot. We would shoot. If you want to kill me, maybe I will defend myself."
I do love him. I want to go to Venice.
Let's go to Venice,
baby.
Let's
go to Venice. I love it.
This is the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Oh, yes, this is the French music we were looking for. Thank you, Mike.
You know, it's not hard, not easy being the president of France. Emmanuel Macron has many obligations, many things that he has to focus on in the course of his job as one of the leaders of the free world, the French world, to be exact. And, you know, one of those things is making sure that his makeup is constantly stocked.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and bright.
Ah, yes. The Associated Press reports that President Emmanuel Macron, his office, has confirmed a report that the French leader spent 26,000 euros on makeup during his first 3 months in power.
What? Wait, for how do we know it's for him and it's not for his wife?
It's for him.
How do we know that?
Well, we know partly because of the details of this report. I'm assuming it's not fake news, but we'll get into it and it might offer you some explanation. But he has spent $30,000. $30,000 on makeup. Can you imagine what kind of makeup you could get as an American woman spending $30,000 over 3 months?
3 months?
Just 3 months. That's $10,000 a month on makeup.
Oh, my God.
The report in Le Point news magazine prompted harsh criticism of the president. He said the cost includes the pay of a freelance makeup artist to follow him for television appearances and trips abroad.
Wow, I am so jealous right now. I never thought I'd be jealous of a man about his makeup budget.
Oh, the makeup is very nice.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM, WMAL.